Nippon Shinyaku Company against Epta Therapeutics Incorporated. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you. May it please the court. William Peterson on behalf of the appellant Nippon Shinyaku. The parties agreed that for a two-year period after the end of the covenant term, all potential actions arising under U.S. law relating to patent invalidity would be filed only in the District of Delaware. The IPRs filed by Sarepta fit squarely within this provision. The district court erred in interpreting the form selection clause and, as a result, erred in denying a preliminary injunction. An initial matter, neither party has argued that the mutual confidentiality agreement is ambiguous, and as an unambiguous agreement, its interpretation is a question of law reviewed de novo by this court. And when contract language is clear and unequivocal, Delaware law requires a court to give that language its plain meaning. Here, there are two requirements potentially in dispute for the application of the form selection clause. One, the IPRs must be potential actions as defined in the MCA. The other is that the IPRs must arise under U.S. law relating to patent invalidity. Both of these are satisfied. Potential actions, as it's used in Section 10, the form selection clause, is capitalized. It is a defined term in the agreement, and that definition includes any patent or other intellectual property disputes between Nippon Shinyaku and Sarepta filed with a court or administrative agency in the United States in connection with the development and commercialization of therapies for Duchenne muscular dystrophy. This report correct.
Is it your view that that precludes the filing of an IPR?
Not on its own, but in Section 10, yes, Your Honor, that is our view, that the IPRs fit within this definition of potential actions as it's defined. If you look at Section 10, it doesn't limit potential actions. It actually says all potential actions. The district court correctly recognized the definition of potential actions literally encompasses IPRs, and that plain language should have been enforced. And then I don't think there's any serious dispute that IPRs arise under U.S. law relating to patent invalidity. IPRs are required to include assertions challenging patent validity under 35 U.S.C. sections 102 or section 103. And as we pointed out in the briefing, in this court's decision in Mylan Labs versus Janssen Pharmaceuticals, the court already noted with reference to 28 U.S.C. 1338A that no state court shall have jurisdiction over any claim for relief arising under any act of Congress relating to patents in reference to IP.
The district court, as I read its opinion, thought that that didn't make sense, that it would create tension. Section 10 would create tension with Section 6, and it would be odd if it deferred filing of IPRs and impliedly delayed them for 2 years. Is it your view that these were improper grounds for the court's decision?
I wouldn't say improper, Your Honor, but I would say incorrect. I will say if there were some ambiguity in the language of Section 10, if there were some dispute about the meaning of the words the parties used, then it might be appropriate to look to Section 6. But failing that, absent some kind of conflict between Section 6 and Section 10, you need to enforce Section 10 according to its plain language. So there's obviously no conflict between the two provisions. Section 10...
You're saying Sarepta just contracted out the right to file IPRs?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what Sarepta agreed to, that all potential actions arising under U.S. law relating to patent infringement or validity shall be filed in the United States District Court for the District of Delaware. Potential actions obviously includes filings before an administrative agency. I think if you ask an objective third party what kind of intellectual property disputes get filed with U.S. administrative agencies, these days any practitioner inter-parties review proceedings would be the very first thing that would come to mind. And I don't think there's any way of saying that an IPR does not arise under U.S. law relating to patent invalidity. Delaware law, consistent with general principles of contract law, holds parties to their bargains and enforces contracts according to their plain language. So let me turn briefly back. Section 6 governs what happens during the contract term, and Section 6 doesn't say we're going to defer or delay IPR proceedings. Section 6 just says broadly, during the contract term, no one is going to file any intellectual property disputes at all. I'm simplifying somewhat, but Section 6 is what happens during the contract term. Section 10 is about what happens after the contract term.
This is Judge Stoll. Section 6 has an express exception for IPRs that would be time barred, right? Whereas Section 10 does not include that kind of express exception, right?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that's correct. There might be some dispute about the precise scope of the exception in Section 6, but there's certainly no exception whatsoever in Section 10. And my friend has argued that this is a waiver, that Sarepta is, I think, losing an impliedly substantive right under this. To be perfectly clear, we are not saying that Sarepta cannot assert any invalidity challenge that it wants to make. It just needs to do so in its chosen form. It needs to make those assertions in the District of Delaware. Another part of the district court's reasoning was the references in Section 10 to forum nonconvenience, personal jurisdiction, and venue. And we agree, of course, you see those references in Section 10, but in context, they're referring to what happens after a potential action is filed in the District of Delaware. Neither party will contest personal jurisdiction or venue in the District of Delaware. It's just not a plausible way of saying that that somehow restricts the scope of what must be filed in the District of Delaware in the first instance. The last argument that I think you'll hear from my friend is going to be in reference to the Kanu decision. There's an argument that Sarepta raised in the briefing that there needs to be a connection between the MCA and the Forum Selection Clause for it to be enforceable, and that's a misreading of the Kanu case. A more typical Forum Selection Clause, like the one in Kanu, might be limited to disputes that arise out of or relate to the agreement or the transactions contemplated thereby. So what this court did in Kanu was look for a connection to see whether the dispute arose out of or related to the agreement. Sarepta misreads that as being a general proposition that applies to all forum selection clauses, regardless of their language, but that's not the case. This court enforces forum selection clauses according to their terms. The terms here are broad. All potential actions arising under U.S. law relating to patent infringement or invalidity.
I just wanted to ask you one quick question. In your blue brief, you argue that if this court agrees with your interpretation of the agreement, that you're entitled to reversal. I realize that you asked for reversal before you saw Judge Stark's decision. And my question is, the decision says that the court need not reach balance of the equities or the public interest. I mean, how could this court possibly reverse in that scenario when there's factors that weren't considered?
Certainly reversing the denial, the question would be the right remedy, whether this court would reverse with an instruction to enter the preliminary injunction.
But would it be a vacate? It would be vacating the denial with instructions to consider, knowing this court's views on the factors that, in fact, the district court addressed. But we can't address factors that the district court didn't even address, right?
Well, I do think there's an exception to that, which we highlighted in the red brief, the reply brief, and that is when there's only one possible resolution of the facts, it is permissible for a court of appeals to touch on issues that were unaddressed in the first instance. And with respect to those factors, this court has discussed them in the general Protect decision, the Backwoodies This court talked about a different form selection clause, but there, having contracted for a specific forum, a plaintiff should not be heard to argue that the enforcement of the contract into which it freely entered would cause hardship. And then on public interest, there is no public interest served by excusing a party's violation of its previously negotiated contractual undertaking to litigate in a particular forum. I'll also note, to its credit, Sarepta has never said that if Nippon Shinyaku is right about the interpretation of the form selection clause, that it still is entitled to go forward with the IPRs. All of Sarepta's arguments, both in the district court and on appeal, have been premised on its interpretation of the form selection clause. So we've just never seen that sort of alternative raised at any stage of the proceedings. Look, we think certainly we have confidence the district court will get this right, regardless of the level of guidance this court gives on remand. But obviously, as our recent 28J letter notes, there have already been institution decisions in two of the seven IPRs. We have decisions coming up very quickly in the remaining ones, and we're eager to have this enforced as soon as possible so we can start getting those IPRs withdrawn and have the parties litigate these issues in their chosen form.
I have one other question. We've received a Rule 28J letter yesterday, I believe. Can you tell me, do you know what the timeline is for the other IPRs? And how does this the fact that the PTAB is, the statutory deadline is passed or on the, some of these IPRs, it's been granted institution in two of the IPRs, how does that impact the case before us?
Let me take that in order. First, there are two that have deadlines on January 21st, two with deadlines on January 24th, and the last has a deadline on the 17th. There were two that were instituted on January 7th. I'll note that it doesn't preclude relief. If you look at the Dodo case VR versus Merch Source decision, that was a case in which this court enforced a form selection clause that barred IPRs that had already been instituted. If you look on page 936 of that decision, you can look at the injunction that was entered there, which required the party that had filed the IPRs to send an email to the PTAB quickly requesting a conference call to facilitate withdrawal, and if the PTAB grants permission to file motions, to file the motions essentially very quickly to withdraw them. So that's the same relief we'd be looking for here. Now, obviously, our goal is to have these withdrawn before institution. We think that post-institution withdrawal may be more difficult, so we're hoping to get as much as we can out of our form selection clause, and that's why we'd ask this court to issue a decision as quickly as possible and frankly, issue the mandate along with the decision rather than waiting the typical time for the rehearing period.
Okay. Any more questions at the moment for Mr. Peterson?
No.
And then we'll hear from the other side. Mr. Flippert.
Thank you, Your Honor. In interpreting the MCA as a whole, as required under Delaware law, the district court first examined Section 6, which specifically addresses the timing of patent validity challenges before the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. The court gave effect.
It says any administrative proceeding. Does it not, Section 6?
It does, Your Honor. It refers to validity challenges before the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office.
Okay. All right. Now, that's yeah. The problem, isn't it?
Yeah. So the court gave effect to this express provision in Section 6, where the parties agreed to defer any validity challenges, including IPRs, for a period of no more than 1 year and 20 days, ending on June 21, 2021, when the covenant term ended. And as the court held in its second order, Section 6 shows the parties' intent to allow IPRs to proceed after the covenant term. And that finding of intent is found at Appendix 1230. And it's quite important because on appeal, Nippon Shinyaku fails to address or challenge the district court's interpretation of Section 6 as showing that the parties intended to allow IPRs after the covenant term expired.
But Mr. Flippert, how about Section 10, which says that all actions filed within 2 years, which these are, shall be filed in the District of Delaware, and potential actions are defined as including those before an administrative agency. So why doesn't that preclude the IPRs that your client files?
Well, yes, Your Honor. Well, first, as I said, the court made this finding of intent that the parties did intend, as shown in Section 6, to allow IPRs after the covenant term expired, and that's a defined period that expired on June 21, 2021. And then under the cardinal rule of contract interpretation in Delaware, the court interpreted Section 10 in light of that intent in Section 6. And that was consistent with the Delaware Supreme Court's decisions in Sonatrol Holding and Elliott Associates, which the court cited and which Nippon Shinyaku doesn't respond to. And then the court, when it looked at Section 10, it identified a number of features of the language that are fully supportive of the court's interpretation of that section as only referring to district court actions.
But these provisions are all in plain English. We don't have to infer intent beyond what the words themselves express.
We do agree that the term potential actions, Your Honor, is a defined term, but the provision in Section 10 does not say all potential actions shall be filed in the District of Delaware. It says all potential actions arising under U.S. law relating to patent infringement or invalidity shall be filed there. So there's a limiting phrase which modifies the definition. It's simply referring to a subset of the more broadly defined potential actions on page 2.
Counsel, this is Judge Stoll. A quick question. Do you dispute the district court's conclusion that the definition of potential action in Section 1 literally encompasses IPRs?
No, we don't dispute that at all. What the judge then said was that read in full context, it states, quote, all potential actions arising under U.S. law relating to patent infringement or invalidity.
What about the or language, or invalidity?
Right, Your Honor. Well, it does say or, but that's where you have to look at the entire sentence. Everything in that sentence refers to district court actions. It refers to subject matter jurisdiction, personal jurisdiction, venue, and transfer. And also, as the court pointed out, that term, potential actions, appears twice in the sentence that we're looking at. And in the second use, the sentence states that neither party will seek to transfer the potential actions on the ground of forum nonconvenience. And, of course, only court cases can be transferred. That phrase, the potential actions, which must refer to court cases, most logically refers back to its antecedent basis at the beginning of the sentence, which refers to potential actions arising under U.S. law relating to patent infringement or invalidity. So we submit it should have the same meaning in both parts of the sentence, not different meanings, as Nippon Shinyaku argues. We submit the plain language supports the court's interpretation when one looks at and reads the entire sentence. But it's also, this sentence refers to and states that the potential actions shall be filed in the District of Delaware. And, of course, IPRs can't be filed in the District of Delaware, so we don't believe the plain language requires or supports that interpretation. In addition, what Nippon Shinyaku is doing here is they're trying to say there are two separate questions. You know, do IPRs meet the definition of potential actions, and then do they meet the arising under language? But that's not the question. This term has to be considered overall as a whole, and which is exactly what the judge did, Judge Stark did. And he gave effect to the modifying language. Another example of that is that it's clear that this modifying language has effect when one looks at the definition of potential actions on page 2 of the agreement. And the court will see that the broader unmodified definition of potential actions at page 2 also includes, for example, non-patent IP disputes, as well as potential cases filed in Europe, Japan, or other countries. But of course, those potential actions are also excluded by section, from Section 10 by the modifying language. And so we submit that the we don't dispute the definition of potential actions as it's, you know, provided on page 2, but the fact is this section, Section 10, is more narrowly written, and there is modifying language that is referring to a subset of these cases that are filed in district court. And everything that the district court identified here is supportive of that more narrow reading. And moreover, again, because the cardinal rule of contract interpretation in Delaware is to provide a harmonious interpretation so that both sections 6 and 10 can be given effect, that is exactly what Judge Stark did. After finding the intent to allow IPRs to proceed after the covenant term, which again is unchallenged on appeal. And when I say unchallenged, if the court looks, for example, at pages 15 to 16 of the reply brief, where Nippon Shinyaku mentions Section 6, it does not address the district court's analysis of Section 6 or argue that the court's finding of intent is erroneous. And given the narrow standard of review that applies to this appeal, we submit that Nippon Shinyaku has failed to dispute or challenge in any way the district court's determination that the parties intended to allow IPRs to proceed after the covenant term expired. And that intent is relevant to Section 10, because there is, of course, a conflict, because if one accepts the court's finding that the parties intended to allow IPRs to proceed after the covenant term expired, that covenant, that is exactly what Sarepta did, and that covenant term expired on June 21, 2021. But Nippon Shinyaku is arguing that no, that parties, you know, that Sarepta was not permitted to file IPRs on that date, even though it was, it is contemplated and permitted under Section 6. So there is a conflict, and Judge Stark recognized that conflict, and he found that the better reading of these two provisions together is to interpret Section 10 as limited to federal district court cases. And again, we believe the plain language does fully support that. And for example, Judge Stark did identify this provision about transfer and the fact that, you know, that is, that can only refer to district court cases. And we submit that that second use eliminates really any question about what the first use of potential actions is referring to.
Should I would have just pressed you a little bit on that. This is Judge Stoll. So it's all one sentence, and it says all potential actions must be filed in the District of Delaware, and neither party will seek to transfer the potential actions on the ground of form non-convenience. Why does that not mean when they talk about the potential actions in the second sentence, they're talking about the actions that must be filed or shall be filed in Delaware? And so therefore it makes sense.
Right. But it also makes sense. We think it makes more sense the way that Judge Stark has construed it. And as I mentioned, it refers to the potential actions, that second use. We think the best reading of that is that it's referring to its antecedent basis at the beginning of the sentence. The antecedent basis
for all potential actions arising under U.S. law relating to patent infringement or invalidity that shall be filed in the United States District Court. Those.
Right. It's referring to the initial reference to potential actions at the beginning of the sentence. We know that the second reference must refer only to court cases because no one disputes that only court cases can be transferred.
And I agree with you. Mike, I'm going to push again. It says there shall be filed in Delaware, and then when it says no one shall seek transfer, why is that not referring to, you know, again, I'm going to read all potential actions or anything under U.S. law relating to patent infringement or invalidity that shall be filed in Delaware? Why shouldn't it mean that?
Well, we think the better reading is in context, as Judge Stark said, is that it's referring to district court cases. And essentially, there is no reference to IPRs in Section 10. What Section 10 was intended is simply a selection of which district court any patent infringement or invalidity district court cases would be litigated in for 2 years. It is a narrower form selection clause, and it should be interpreted that way, consistent with Section 6, because Section 6 does expressly address the timing of IPR challenges before the board, of patent validity challenges. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Clifford, invalidity certainly includes IPRs, and the express definition of potential actions does include administrative agency. And so when you talk about the forum nonconvenience sentence and focus on the word the potential actions, putting that meaning on the seems to me it weighs a lot less than the express definition of potential actions and the fact that invalidity does include IPRs.
Well, Your Honor, the express, as I mentioned, the express definition also includes, for example, cases in Japan and cases in Europe. And plainly, those were not contemplated here. So Section 10 does not simply apply the broad definition of potential actions. It is a subset of the potential actions, and it's referring to cases in district court. It's an affirmative statement about the cases relating to patent infringement, which we know are district court cases, or invalidity that will be filed in district court. And it is not referring to IPRs. There's no mention of IPRs. And one has to read the agreement as a whole, as the district court did, to see that it's Section 6, not Section 10, that deals with the timing of any IPR filings. And I did want to just briefly respond to the point that the argument that Sarepta has never disagreed that a preliminary injunction should be granted if the court agrees with Nippon Shinyaku's interpretation. That's incorrect. As we argued, for example, on page 19 of the red brief, we argued that Nippon Shinyaku has disregarded the narrow standard of review that applies in this appeal, and under controlling Third Circuit law, for example, the Riley case and the Spartacus case, even if Nippon Shinyaku could show legal error in the district court's contract interpretation, it still hasn't shown that the district court abused its discretion in finding no irreparable harm. Under the Third Circuit practice, Nippon Shinyaku would have to show harmful error in both gateway factors to even reach the balance of equities and public interest factors, and it has not done so here. So we certainly disagree with the assertion that we have conceded that an injunction would have to be entered in this case if the court agreed with Nippon Shinyaku's construction. We don't agree with that, and we argued that on page 19 of the red brief.
You're saying, if I hear you correctly, that all of these proceedings, even if we should decide in favor of your opponent, that we should allow all of these proceedings to take the time and expense of the parties and of the board to proceed until we get around to writing an opinion?
Well, Your Honor, Nippon Shinyaku has cited no case that supported their position that this court could simply reverse the preliminary injunction and direct another injunction to be entered. The case law does not support that. The four factors would have to be considered by the district court under a different construction and rebalanced. The district court would have to be given an opportunity to balance the four factors. This is not a one-factor analysis. It's a four-factor analysis. And the district court only made very brief preliminary comments about the third and fourth factors and has not had an opportunity to fully consider all of the factors. The public interest, for example, I understand that a third IPR was granted this morning, and there is a public interest in removing patents that should not have issued that are unpatentable. So there are countervailing public interests. There is the harm to Sarepta if Sarepta's statutory right to file IPRs, to pursue these IPRs, is going to be taken away. That would be severe harm to Sarepta, irreparable harm, as the district court found. And if the court were to disagree on the contract interpretation, it would be appropriate to vacate and remand this case to Judge Stark, not to reverse. And there's been no case cited by Nippon Shinyaku that would support simply reversing and directing the district court to enter a preliminary injunction.
Mr. Fudge, this is Judge Stoll. I have a quick question. I understand you're saying you're preserved an argument on page 19 of your red brief about irreparable harm, but one of the concerns I have is I look at the district court's opinion in paragraph 5 on pages 6 and 7 of the district court's opinion, and that whole discussion of irreparable harm is premised on the contract conclusion, that is, interpreting the contract to say that there was an IPR could be filed. So don't those two prongs and the preliminary injunction rise and fall together?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. The court was responding to the only argument that Nippon Shinyaku presented, and so that was the only argument Nippon Shinyaku presented for irreparable harm. That doesn't strengthen its position. In Dodo case, for example, the chairman of Dodo case put in a declaration. There was testimony that Dodo case was a small company that only had 4 employees, that it would be financially harmed by the parallel proceedings. There's no such evidence of irreparable harm in this case that was entered. And so this is a situation where Nippon Shinyaku chose to put in no evidence whatsoever on irreparable harm beyond its argument on the contract interpretation. So that doesn't make their position stronger. And the court was simply responding to the argument that was presented.
You're saying that there needs to be a remand so the court can reconsider it in light of new determinations on contract interpretation. Now, do you agree that the district court didn't reach the balance of the equities or the public interest, even though there's a little bit of inconsistency? And paragraph 6, it says, given the court's conclusions on the first two factors, the court need not reach the balance of the equities or public interest. But then in paragraph 7 on the next page, it says, Nippon does not meet its burden on any of the factors it must establish in order to obtain a preliminary injunction. So I think it didn't address the balance of the equities and the public interest, but there is that sentence that someone might cite in paragraph 7.
Yes, Your Honor. The court addressed it only in a brief way, primarily to point out that Nippon Shinyaku's arguments on the third and fourth factors, again, really simply were repeating the same argument on the contract interpretation, and the court disagreed with those arguments and found them unpersuasive. But the court has not had an opportunity to balance all of these 4 factors. If there is a different contract interpretation, that is certainly something that the district court should have an opportunity to reconsider and weigh these 4 factors.
Okay, any more questions for Ms. Peters?
No.
And for Mr. Herbert? All right, thank you. Then, Mr. Peterson, you have your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me start where my friend left off with the preliminary injunction factors. First, I would invite you to look at Sarepta's briefing in the trial court on the preliminary injunction. It's appendix pages 897 through 901. And what you will see there is essentially the same argument that was adopted by the district court, and that is that Nippon Shinyaku has not satisfied the second, third, and fourth elements because its contract interpretation is wrong. The very second sentence on its irreparable harm is, as established, Section 10 relates only to potential district court's actions, not IPR petitions. So Sarepta's arguments against a preliminary injunction have always been premised on its contract interpretation and on the argument that the Forum Selection Clause does not apply to IPR petitions. I'm not aware of any case in which this court has held that a Forum Selection Clause does apply and yet nonetheless allowed it to be nullified and not enforced by a preliminary injunction. And that's what this court noted in General Protect, was if you don't enforce these Forum Selection Clauses through injunctive relief, the form selection clauses are reduced to a nullity. You see the same thing with the balance of equities, both in General Protect and I think Dodo case comments on this as well. My friend talked a little bit about public interest in challenging patent validity. Well, as it notes, Sarepta, in that case, MedSource, would still be able to challenge the validity of the patents. It would just have to do so in the chosen form. And, of course, independent third parties could initiate separate PTAB proceedings if there were any true public interest and not just a dispute between the parties. And then with respect to the public interest, again, you see courts consistently saying that there is a public interest in enforcing these contractual agreements to select a form and not a public interest in excusing violations of agreements. With respect briefly on Section 6, I'll just note that it doesn't say anything expressly about what will happen after the contract term. Section 6 does not say inter-parties review proceedings can be filed at a certain point in time. Section 6 just says, here's what's going to happen during the contract term. It's silent about what's going to happen afterwards. After the contract term, Section 10 takes over and says all of your invalidity arguments need to be raised in the District of Delaware. And Judge Lori and Judge Stoll, you're absolutely correct. The reference with the definite article, the potential actions, and that last sentence of Section 10, I think in context, is very much a reference to the potential actions that, as the form selection clause requires, are filed in the District of Delaware. Note it's immediately preceded by the reference to neither party contesting personal jurisdiction or venue in the District of Delaware. It would be very odd to read that last piece as somehow referring to not contesting venue, or I'm sorry, not seeking to transfer potential actions on form nonconvenience if they're filed in the Eastern District of Texas, for example. In context, it's very much referring to what will happen after a potential action is filed in the District of Delaware. Particularly with the additional institutions decision this morning, we would just urge that the court move as quickly as possible, whether that's with a remand for guidance from the district court or more of a full reversal instructing the district court to enter the preliminary injunction. The plain language of this agreement is clear. Courts enforce form selection clauses according to their plain language, and precedent supports the application or the imposition of a preliminary injunction in this context. Unless there are further questions, that is my time.
Well, see, any more questions for counsel?
No.
No.
All right. In that case, thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under submission. That concludes the court's argument calendar for this morning.
The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.